Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in British Studies. I'm your host, Christina Fryer. Thanks for joining us. Today I'm speaking with Mark William Palin, author of the new book, The Conspiracy of Free Trade, The Anglo-American Struggle Over Empire and Economic Globalization, 1846 to 1896, published this year by Cambridge University Press. Palin challenges accounts of late 19th century U.S. expansionism that commonly refer to an open-door empire, an imperialism spurred by a belief in free trade. Instead, he notes, American free traders debated but ultimately lost out to a powerful version of protectionist economic nationalism that was inspired by German-American economic theorist Frederick List. I hope you enjoy the interview. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in British Studies. I'm Christina Fryer, the host of the channel. And today we're talking with Mark William Palin, author of the new book, The Conspiracy of Free Trade, The Anglo-American Struggle Over Empire and Economic Globalization, 1846 to 1896. This is out with Cambridge University Press. Mark, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
So I was wondering if you could start by just telling us a little bit about yourself, especially why you became a historian.
Well, I'll give the very, very brief version, and that was that I hadn't planned on it. I was at the University of Texas at Austin. I'd finished a BA in the classics, and I was sort of floundering around and decided I'd give my shot at as an actuary. And in doing so, I ended up taking some history classes. I just couldn't help myself, and I ended up taking a history class with a guy named A.G. Hopkins, mm-hmm. who I'd was not all that familiar with at the time, although I did become much more so as the semesters wore on. And it was A.G. Hopkins who wrote this book with Peter Kane, British Imperialism, that I found out one of the best books written on the subject and just an amazing teacher. And he took me under his wing and said, I should go to graduate school and become a historian. And I guess that was the direction I needed. And after he said it, I said, actually, this – I could see that, and the rest is, as they say, is history. So I ended up getting into the PhD program at UT in 2007, and finished up in 2011, and since then ended up here at the University of Exeter in England.
Wow! I mean, for those of us who do British Empire, of course, Hopkins and Kane, very important scholars in developing the idea of gentlemanly capitalism. I had no idea that Hopkins at least was so aggressive in hunting down and transforming the career paths of future historians.
I mean, to this day, it's still sort of a surprise to me as well. And I imagine too that you can see a bit of his influence in the book.
To a degree, So what brought you to this specific project?
I kept coming across references to Secretary of State Cordell Hull as an American Cobdenite. Secretary of State Cordell Hull, he was the Secretary of State under Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the 1930s and early 1940s, the longest serving Secretary of State who oversaw not only the creation of the United Nations, but also the American turn away from protectionism to free trade. It was largely owing to his efforts. And so you had all these references to him as this American Cobdenite. But to me, there's where's the history of the ideas of and the influence of Cobdenism in America, and it wasn't there. So, you know, in other words, that was sort of the string that I kept pulling on, and it taking me further and further and back in time. And that is, how did we get an American Cobdenite, this adherent to this British free trade ideology of the Victorian period, in the Secretary of State position in the 1930s in the United States? And so this is how it kind of organically grew from there.
Interesting. Now, you say in the introduction that there is sort of this loose idea that the U.S. was a free trade nation in the late 19th century, or at least that its imperial expansion was motivated by free trade. And you challenge that idea pretty strongly. But where did that idea come from?
I think, once again, you have here the influence of British ideas and ideologies and theories at work. I'd say it really begins with William Mappaman Williams, who is this probably the most influential historian of American formulations, at least in the last 50 years or so, who wrote a book in 1959 called The Tragedy of American Diplomacy. And in this, he put forth this idea of an open-door empire. And this open-door empire, in his view, was this desire, this incessant desire throughout American history to open up and acquire new markets, often imperialistically, forcefully, and essentially in the name of free trade, to try to open the markets to American manufacturers and American goods. And he sees this as the impetus, as this driving force behind imperial expansion throughout much of American history, particularly in the late 19th century. And of course, in coming, if you think about the timing of it, 1959, this is just 6 years after the publication of probably the most influential article in imperial historiography by Gallagher and Robinson, mm-hmm. The Imperialism of Free Trade. And actually, Williams, in fact, cites the imperialism of free trade and directly references it as sort of, he says, the American open-door empire is America's version of British free trade imperialism. So he's directly drawing on these British ideas and theories of informal empire and applying them to the United States. What I'm trying to say is that might work for some parts of the United States. Perhaps you can make the case for, you know, once the United States actually turns to free trade at home and abroad. But in the late 19th century, this is as far from the case as possible. This is a time of extreme protectionism, of extreme economic nationalism in the United States under Republican auspices. And so there's been a misapplication, this categorization of free trade and laissez-faire in the United States at this time period.
So let's get into some of the meat of the book. And as you note, you're trying to challenge this idea that the U.S. was a free trade imperialist nation from the late 19th century onward. And you have these two political economic ideologies that you find are really battling it out in the late 19th century Anglo-American sphere. The first of these is Cobdenite free trade cosmopolitanism, and then the second is Listian economic nationalism. Could you define these two for us?
Yeah, so Cobdenite cosmopolitanism, or Cobdenism as it was referred to at the time, is the idea that it's based on this kind of precepts that Adam Smith laid out in The Wealth of Nations in 1776. Cobden was a disciple of Smith. He took the international dimensions of Smith's Wealth of Nations and turned it to this internationalist creed. In a way, it was calling for the, you know, gradual devolution or even decolonization of the British Empire through free trade. And that if not only Britain, but the world adopted free trade policies, opened their markets to one another, that the world becomes so integrated, interconnected, everyone would prosper, but also it would mean that it would be a greater transfer world peace, that you wouldn't go to war with your trading partners, right? So there's a Pacific dimension to it, as well as a prosperity dimension to this Cobdenite idea of free trade that he espoused so influentially at this time. So that's the one. And the other one is this Listian nationalism, as I call it. This is based on the ideas laid out by the German-American economic theorist Friedrich List, who was actually alive and writing at the same time as Richard Cobden in the early to mid-19th century. And in fact, Friedrich List writes his work in many ways to try to counteract the influence of Adam Smith and Richard Cobden at this time by articulating this alternative idea for economic development, one that was actually in many ways antithetical, at least in the short term, to these free trade ideas. That is that countries first and foremost have to look out for themselves. They have to develop their own infant industries. And maybe once they mature, then you can actually have this conversation. But until that happens, it doesn't. And these two ideologies actually get wrapped into this idea of imperial expansion. The way they map out is it's surprisingly neat. For the most part, how the free trade adherents, the Cobdenites, tended towards anti-imperialism, or at least very, very weak forms of informal imperialism, whereas the Listians tended to be, not only in the United States, but also throughout the British Empire, tended to be the strongest advocates of strong imperial expansion and even formal empire.
And just so that we're all clear, because you do make this clear in the book, by free trade, you do not mean zero tariffs, correct?
Yeah, I think that's a common way of describing it now. I mean, we do live in an age now where nations that subscribe to these free trade policies probably have the lowest tariff levels of any time during history. But it's easy to forget that in the 19th century, there was no such thing as really direct taxation. There was a bit of it here and there. The British tried, but nothing on the scale that we know it today through like the income tax. So most of revenues for government came through indirect taxation, primarily through tariffs. So thing here is that free trade in the 19th century, therefore, still meant that you had tariffs, but they were purely for revenue purposes. They weren't to discourage or discriminate against foreign imports into those countries.
So Cobden dies in 1865, is that correct? And yeah. List dies in 1846. And yet we have these ideas really spreading pretty widely through U.S. political circles. So how did they become so popular in the U.S., even though the two main developers of these ideas are not really part of the picture?
I'll start with – it makes sense maybe to start with Friedrich List first, because he's so much more of a direct – You can directly trace these things because Friedrich List actually he lived in the United States for quite a few years in the 1820s, and it was during this time he actually becomes a citizen of the United States. And it's also here where he learns and reads up on these Hamiltonian ideas of protectionism and adapts them to the mid 19th century economic sphere. And so you can actually trace the direct influence of Friedrich List during those American years, as well as the subsequent disciples that make their way through American political circles, Henry Carey being a big one, who was this economic advisor for the Republican Party throughout the mid-19th century, also from Pennsylvania. They knew each other, or at least they would have overlapped in Philadelphia during this time. And you can see it in a variety of other, and this is one of the things I do is I trace these Listian ideas as they developed into the late 19th century. Cobden, on the other hand, he was a transatlantic man in his own right. What I've ended up finding, this is one of the surprising ones, is how Cobdenism actually took root in the United States. And it actually ended up taking me down this road of studying anti-slavery ideology as well, which maybe we can get into more detail. But the short version of this is that Cobden was really good friends with a lot of the leading liberal, even radical voices among elites in the United States at this time. Ralph Waldo Emerson, William Lloyd Garrison, a lot of these big names at the time were very close with Cobden, right, his circle of free traders in the United States. And this Pacific dimension that was also closely connected to evangelical Christianity was very enticing to some of these liberal reformers in the United States. And so it's them who take it back through personal friendships and otherwise. They take this idea of Cobdenism and try to implement it in the United States.
So, I think this next question will get us into this question about anti-slavery. These two ideologies they're very different. They have very different views of visions of the economic future, and yet before the Civil War, they are in a tenuous alliance within the Republican Party. Can you tell us why that is and why it was so tenuous?
And I think that the thing there, too, is, as you touched on with the previous question, is that these are both, at least in this antebellum period, they're just starting to gain adherence in the United States. And so they're not the dominant ideology of any Republican Party or any party at this time, Republican or otherwise. But what you have is what I've tried to do here is to show that through an ideological approach to the 1850s party formation, the creation of the Republican Party, what you see is essentially you have – in the United States at this time, you have this dominant Jeffersonian free trade tradition in the South, that's closely tied to slavery and to agrarianism and the plantation system. And then you have this new influx of Cobdenism in the Northeast, Boston and New York, that is a different type of free trade ideology that's tied closely to what we call classical liberal ideas of freedom. And so they saw free trade as actually closely entwined with liberation of mankind. And so you're going to see this anti-slavery free trade ideology of Cobdenism that's going to find its complement, at least in the 1850s, when the Republican Party is first and foremost the party of anti-slavery. And so even though there might have been different economic ideas battling it out within the Republican Party at this time, this overarching adherence to anti-slavery ideas is going to dominate and prevail and tenuously tie them together. So these Listians, these other protectionists, are in the majority in the Republican Party in the 1850s and after, but they're able to see past these differences, at least in the short term, because of their shared fight for anti-slavery.
Right. So there's this fragile alliance. The Listians are starting to become in the majority. And I think almost throughout the entire period, the Cobdenites are in a minority in the Republican Party, and then eventually, as we'll discuss, out of the Republican Party. As we move into the 1860s, as the book moves into the 1860s, this alliance begins to fracture. And it's fracturing primarily, or maybe in part, because of the moral tariff. Can you talk to us about the moral tariff?
Or as some British critics refer to it as the immoral tariff.
Yes.
Yeah, this is one of those great misunderstandings of history that I actually find myself pushing back against the most. I'm sure you and listeners have come across this plenty of times too, the lost cause narrative, especially during the anniversary of the Civil War that we're having here, and all these age-old kind of ideas about why the Civil War broke out. And one of the ones you always hear is it was about tariffs. And it's just almost completely and utterly absurd once you get into the details of it, which, I mean, I can go into if you'd like. But what I try to show is that the tariff issue wasn't the primary cause of the Civil War, but I think it was one of the primary causes of Anglo-American tensions. And one of the reasons how this myth perpetuates itself is actually because of the British. I think it actually really starts in Great Britain during the Civil War, where it's actually the British have adopted free trade. They've essentially are adhering to free trade now as an ideology, this Cobdenite idea. And so it's easier for them to see the Civil War as a war between protectionist Northeast versus the free trade South, especially because it would take a couple years before Lincoln would make the war overtly about ending slavery. So yeah, so when the North passes this moral tariff in 1861, this is often misconstrued as one of the main reasons for South secession, when in fact most of the Southern states had already seceded by the time this bill was passed. You can see how this is all leading to a lot of complications at the time, and how even to this day, without the right chronology, it can be very misleading. So the moral tariff then becomes this very, very big diplomatic wedge. The South tries to essentially exaggerate and perpetuate this myth that the tariff issue had caused the break between North and South. And it's something that is very tantalizing, at least in the first couple of years in free trade England. And this is something, for whatever reason, is largely missing from all accounts of Anglo-American relations during the 1860s.
Interesting. And one of the things that I found most fascinating in your description of this is the way that basically the news seems to be coming into London that Southern slave states are seceding at the same time that they're hearing about the moral tariff. And so they make this sort of causation narrative that doesn't exist, then it sort of basically runs their diplomacy for the next few years. And then, of course, becomes a something very difficult for us to untangle later. So how does the moral tariff impact the Cobdenites?
There, I mean, in both sides of the Atlantic are they find it abhorrent, needless to say. They're very upset because they already see it, and they're already seeing aspects of the Republican Party who are already showing themselves willing to sacrifice the anti-slavery cause because they want to make this party the party of protectionism rather than the party of anti-slavery. And this is even before the slaves have been freed. You're starting to see this tension there. And so the moral tariff is seen with great abhorrence on both sides. Richard Cobden and John Bright in Britain, and these American free traders within the Republican Party, are horribly against it, but they're also even more against this myth that arises around it. So one of the things that I trace too is that it's actually the Cobdenites, despite their objections to the moral tariff, who go on a really extensive propaganda campaign by 1863 to make sure that people in Britain know that this is not what the war was about at all. It's about anti-slavery first and foremost. And so, yeah, so that's the Cobdenites. Yes, they're against it. Little could they see how this would continue in Republican policymaking, this protectionist element into the 1860s.
And it seems as though, to move forward in time a little bit, that in sort of the mid-1860s, the Cobdenites, the transatlantic free trade movement seems to actually be growing. The Cobdenites feel as though they're getting some measure of success. But as it grows, it's starting to draw attention and draw charges that actually this is a British conspiracy, that free trade is a British conspiracy. Can you walk us through this? Because this seems pretty central to the entire book.
Sure. Yeah, no, I think you're right. And, you know, and this goes back to this historiographical intervention about pushing back against this portrayal of late 19th century America as one of laissez-faire and free trade. Mm-hmm. When in fact, anybody who espoused free trade ideas at this time was often considered to be part of some vast British plot to undermine the American economy. You know, taken in the context of the, you know, from the mid-19th century onwards, when you really start to see a truly global marketplace come into existence, these issues of trade become ever more important and influential. And in the United States, which is much lower in the developmental scale when it comes to industries as that of Britain, they see this idea of adopting free trade at this time to be something that would be great for Britain, but really bad for the United States because they wouldn't be able to compete with Britain's cheaper goods flooding American market. So it's the ideology meets sort of pragmatic pocketbook issues. And so battle over whether it's good for consumers to be able to access and have access to cheap goods, and whether or not this would bring maybe international peace, or whether or not we need to protect American industries from the full brunt of market competition with Europe, with Britain at this time is coming into play. And you can see that, you know, if you think of the Republican Party as it often, I think, should be seen as the party of big business really since its foundations, it was looking out for these infant industries in the United States. And it's going to be the Republican Party that's going to see this, what they see as this insidious influence of free trade ideas in the United States as this covert attempt. And of course, as I also show, there are a lot of strong links between the American free trade movement and the Cobdenite free trade movement in England. Right, the Cobden Club in London that's created in 1866 has really close ties with the leaders of the American free trade movement. You know, it's a who's who of American Cobden Club members, and so there actually are these real connections between the American free trade movement and these British free traders, which gives. For some, at least, it gives more credence to these charges that there is this conspiracy to destroy the growing American economy before it's able to fully mature.
So there's this sense of a sort of conspiracy paranoia that's really tying in with certain levels of Anglophobia as well, would you say?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. And that's a good point. The other aspect of this is that, again, this other thing that we tend to read back into history, and that is that the United States and Britain had this special relationship when throughout the 19th century, at least this was as far from the case as could be. Of course, the United States had a violent revolution against the British Empire, followed by another war, the War of 1812. During the Civil War, these tensions are exacerbated once again because the British maintain a neutral policy stance towards the Civil War and are even seen by some in the North as tacitly supporting the South. And so by the late 1860s, 1870s, Anglophobia is extremely strong in the United States, this fear, this hatred of the British. And this is something else that the Republicans are able to tap into. So you have this confluence of protectionist, anti-free trade elements to this anti-British sentiment, as well as this longer history of hatred and fear of the British that the Republicans can draw on.
So throughout the 1860s, there are Cobdenites in the Republican Party. They are a minority and really struggling to be more successful than the Listian majority. And then as you sort of move through the 1870s and the early 1880s, and of course, this is also at the point of Reconstruction, there is a massive realignment in the political structure as the Cobdenites move away from the Republican Party. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Right after the Civil War, there is a glimmer of hope. The Cobdenites in the Republican Party, always a minority, still feel like maybe they can change it from within, that they can reform the Republican Party. It's still in its nascent years. Maybe they can redirect it from its increasingly economic nationalist trajectory and maybe change the Republican Party, make it the party of free trade, of Cobdenism. And they finally throw up their hands in 1872, and they run that as a third party ticket. This is called the Liberal Republican Movement, and they run this Liberal Republican ticket in 1872 that initially, at least, is supposed to be a free trade ticket. This ends in abysmal failure. Perhaps here are lessons as well for there's today. I guess we can like this later, but you know, there's talk today of these free market Republicans thinking about running an alternative to Trump. But so this 1872, it's such an abysmal failure, their attempt to run a third party, that they decide to do something different in 1884. And in 1884, they're once again faced with a Republican nominee in the name of James G. Blaine, who is this diehard protectionist and imperial expansionist, two things that go against the Cobdenite tenets. And they're just fed up. And so on the Democratic side, they have this governor from New York who's reform-minded, who seems to see eye to eye on a lot of these issues, including on this issue of free trade, Grover Cleveland. This is when they make the fateful decision that instead of running a third party, instead of trying to reform their party from within, they're going to abandon the Republican Party and throw their support behind the Democrat, Grover Cleveland. And this is when they become known famously, at least at the time, as the Mugwumps. This is the Mugwump turn. And they're seen as party traitors thereafter. There's this even more animosity between the Cobdenites and their former Republican brethren thereafter. But it's really important, too. I mean, we can't quite get into the details or we can't quite be certain here, but it is pretty clear that this influence of these elite Northeastern Cobdenites, their support for Grover Cleveland helped him win the election of 1884.
Interesting. And there are a series of quite tight elections. As many listeners may know, Cleveland served two terms, but non-consecutively. It is Cleveland, then it is Benjamin Harrison, who is more back in line with economic nationalism, and then Cleveland term two. So if we sort of, I don't really want to conflate those because there's a lot there, but as I was reading it, it struck me that these three terms, there's really a pretty significant conflict over the U.S. role in the world. Would you agree with that characterization?
Yeah. I mean, this issue of trade, American trade with the world, whether it's going to be a one of free trade or one dominated by economic nationalism, really is the dominant issue. Depending on the year, sometimes it's the monetary issue, gold standard versus silver, which I think are often intertwined with one another. But this is a period, and maybe this is one of the reasons why the late 19th century is so often ignored, is because it is so much about economic issues. And I think the reason why those economic issues are so important, though, this is when the United States is when the political parties and others within the American policymaking community are trying to figure out how does the United States fit itself into this growing world of globalization, right? So how does the United States integrate with the global economy? And this is, to me, what this trade debate is about. And ultimately, this is going to shape the course of American imperial expansion as well.
Now, one thing that happens during the term of Benjamin Harris, it has to do with Harris, but it actually foreshadows another player, is the 1890 McKinley Tariff. And this seems to me to be perhaps the most central piece of legislation that you describe in the last several chapters of the book. So can you tell us about McKinley? This is, of course, William McKinley, who would become president. But can you tell us about his economic policy as well as the specifics, or as many specifics as you want to give us, about the McKinley Tariff?
Yeah, so it's William McKinley was known as the Napoleon of Protection. And he was a disciple. Essentially, one of the things I do is you can trace his protectionist ideas and his evolution of his protectionist ideas as it becomes ever more expansionist in its outlook to these ideas of Frederick List and American disciples in between the 1840s and when William McKinley becomes more influential and ultimately president in the late 1890s. So in 1890, William McKinley is a congressman in the House of Representatives, and he starts working on this this protectionist tariff bill. This is during the presidency of Benjamin Harrison, as you pointed out, this Republican who sits in between the two presidencies of Grover Cleveland. So it was 1889 to 1893 is the Harrison years. Harrison appoints as the Secretary of State James G. Blaine, the same Blaine who was the presidential nominee in 1884, this right. hardcore protectionist and imperial expansionist. And so William McKinley is in a good spot, and the Republicans are have a majority in both houses of Congress. They have the executive. This is their time. So he moves forward with this bill, and I won't get into the play-by-play, blow-by-blow, but what this McKinley tariff ends up having in it is something that I consider to be a revolutionary aspect, and I'm not the first. The Wisconsin School of Foreign Relations historians have touched on this, but maybe not in the same way, and that is it includes a reciprocity provision. And what this allows, it allows for the protectionist policy of the United States to actually expand itself into foreign markets. And this is one of the reasons why I think this time of protectionism has been misconstrued as one of free trade, because the United States is trying to expand its markets. The only difference is it's not actually trying to do so through some sort of free trade lens. It's actually trying to expand its protectionist boundaries. And acquire new markets and create its own sort of neo-mercantilist system. And this is able to be done in a big way because of this reciprocity provision of the McKinley Tariff of 1890. This allows the United States, the President of the United States, to sign bilateral treaties with countries, but with the threat of retaliation if that country does not do essentially what it says it's going to. So, and it also makes sure, too, that those countries that are signatories can't sign a similar trade agreement, a reciprocity agreement with any other countries. So rather than actually expanding free trade as the free traders would have liked, this actually limits the free trade aspects of these reciprocity agreements, as well as allowing this sort of coercive element for the United States to punish these mainly Latin American signatories if they stepped out of line.
Mm. So this is what you characterize as the closed door empire, correct?
That's right. Yeah, this is the beginnings of it. This is going to allow for it. It allows the United States to access these markets that it didn't previously have access to, mainly in Latin America, at least in the early 1890s. But in doing so, it's actually expanding the America's protectionist bloc when it expands into these countries. So, you know, and this is going to take on an even greater role once the United States acquires a colonial empire after the Spanish-American War. It's telling that what is the United States under well, then President William McKinley do with these colonies once it gets them? It makes them these protectionist enclaves for the United States. It doesn't make them open doors, right? So this right. is there's plenty of examples here, beginning with the McKinley Tariff, in which the United States is expanding, yes, acquiring new markets, yes, but under the rubric of protectionism rather than a free trade.
Now, this causes some problems for the British Empire, in particular because of the two areas of the British Empire that the increasingly expanding U.S. borders or neighbors, which would be, of course, Canada and the British Caribbean. So can you talk to us about the impact the McKinley Tariff had on the British Empire? There's some actually pretty significant ideological changes happening back in Britain.
Yeah, and it doesn't begin with the McKinley Tariff. But one of the things that, again, this is largely missing from the imperial historiography from the British side is the importance of American protectionist legislation on the changing dynamics of British imperial expansion. Mm-hmm. So you have the Cobdenites who are sort of running the show from the 1840s until around 1870. But then you start to see a bit of a retreat from these Cobdenite adherents, Gladstone being probably the most prominent one in Britain at that time. And you start to see a resurgence of British protectionism, not just in Great Britain, but actually throughout the British Empire. And in fact, one of the things that I discovered in getting into this is that the leaders of this protectionist imperial movement within the British Empire, they were largely turning to Frederick List for inspiration. So you have this Listian influence within the British Empire too, challenging the Cobdenite orthodoxy. So it gets to the point that one of the things they're saying too is that, you know, Cobden and Adam Smith said that if we turn to free trade, the rest of the world would follow suit. But in reality, what's happening, and the McKinley Tariff is a prime example of this, is that the world is doing the exact opposite. And so now we need to change things up. We can't keep going along with this. We need to fight tit for tat. We need to punish the United States through our own protective tariffs, and then maybe we could sit down at the table and renegotiate. So this is what's going on, and this is what the McKinley-Taylor helped spark, is this crisis within the British Empire in the late 19th century, as the Covenant orthodoxy is increasingly under attack, not just in the metropole, but throughout the White Empire. The Canada, South Africa, Australia in particular, you're starting to see these protectionist elves. In fact, Canada, South Africa, and Australia, and a variety of Australian colonies are all turning to protectionism at this time. Mm-hmm. So Great Britain more and more is sort of sitting by itself as this free trade lighthouse to which most of the world is ignoring. And yeah, the economic impact of the McKinley Tariff on the British Empire is something that I trace. On these imperial debates is something that I trace. And then, of course, as you point out, this is probably the most important for Canadian-American relations and how Canada ends up fitting within the global economic system. And this ends up being the 1891 Canadian federal elections. In many ways, this election was about whether or not Canada would tie itself more closely economically and even perhaps politically with the United States because of the McKinley Tariff, or whether or not it would actually tie its economic future with the British Empire. And the Conservatives win. They defeat the Covenants, the Liberals in Canada in the 1891 elections. And it's because of this that for essentially 100 years, Canada and the United States would not have free trade.
Mm.
It hinged upon this. So even on that local level, you can see the effects of these protectionist policies playing out in the British Empire.
So the McKinley Tariff sort of, presages McKinley's rise to power, as well as his particular brand of protectionist expansion. And in the final chapter, basically, it seems as though the Listians are in full control by the end of the 19th century, which is the general traditional starting point in the historiography, at least, of an American overseas expansion, particularly into the Caribbean. What else should we know about McKinley's term as president?
Well, I think one of the main reasons for the common portrayal of this as an open door or free trade imperial expansion, colonial acquisition under McKinley. Of course, it ignores, as I said, the fact that this is the Napoleon of protection, and he lived and he died a protectionist through and through. But that it, you know, this construing of it, it's because of the open door notes. So his Secretary of State, when William McKinley is president during the acquisition of these various colonial territories, this is also the same time when his Secretary of State, John Hay, enunciates the open door notes, calling for open access, equal access to the China market, where the United States did not have any real influence or access to. And so because of this enunciation of what kind of sounds like free trade, this Republican administration of William McKinley and this imperial policy is commonly portrayed as one of free trade. And one of the things I'm trying to show here is that you have to ignore that rhetoric and look at the realities. What are the actual policies that they're implementing? How does this fit within the larger rubric of this expansionist protectionist doctrine that the Republicans were practicing under William McKinley? And so that's, I think, the key there is going back and actually rediscovering the protectionist roots of American imperial expansion. That strikes a stark contrast, perhaps, with the post-1945 U.S. Advocacy of free trade ideas.
Right.
And William McKinley epitomizes this.
So you've basically opened the door to the 20th century and 21st century. This book is particularly timely. We've already hinted at some of the ways that it's timely at the moment, as certainly there's a rise again in protectionist discourse. What would you say are the key consequences in the 20th and now 21st century of this battle between the Cobdenites and the Listians?
By and large, I'd say for the first half of the 20th century, it's really a Listian world. And if you look at the long history of the Republican Party, it's the anomaly, the exception to the rule is the Republican adoption of free trade ideas under the Reagan administration.
Okay.
Of the 1980s. And it has since been sort of this, what we think of as this orthodoxy of Republican economic ideology. But in reality, looking at it from the party's foundation of the 1850s into the present, that's the anomaly. And so one of the things I've tried to say is that from this longer historical perspective, Donald Trump's advocacy of protectionist ideas is quite in keeping with Republican ideas. This is actually a return to the status quo.
Interesting.
And in many ways, I mean, I think maybe one of the more striking things about this, I mean, I don't think that I mean, Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, was much more supportive of various trade liberalization schemes. Mm-hmm. I think her as a presidential nominee is, I think, for political purposes, is moving away from that. But I think there's a clear difference between where Clinton falls on this. She's still much more, I think, of the long-term Democratic adherence to free trade that we would expect. It's just not quite so noticeable during an election year.
Right. I've taken up enough of your time. Thank you so much for speaking with us. We do have one final question that we always ask, which is, what are you working on now?
The new project is, in a certain sense, it's a continuation of the last one. So the last one ends at around 1896, 1900. The new one is a look at this free trade protectionist conflict that takes on an even more global cast in the early 20th century. And it plays an even bigger role, I think, in debates over imperial expansion and peace advocacy. So this is actually it's an economic history of the international peace movement of the 20th century.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, we are definitely looking forward to that project. So, Mark Palin, I want to thank you again for talking with us today here at New Books in British Studies about your book, The Conspiracy of Free Trade. I really enjoyed our conversation. Hope you did as well.
Thank you. I did. Thank you for having me again.
You've been listening to New Books in British Studies. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.